Well, I'm in over my head, no one told me. Trying to keep my footprint small was harder than I thought it could be. I'm in over my head, what do I really need? Trying to save the planet, oh, will someone please save me? Trying to save the planet, oh, will someone please save me?
Welcome to In Over My Head. I'm Michael Bartz. While exploring the Old Man Watershed, I wanted to discover the history of water development in this area. My first conversation had me learning about the creation story of the Old Man River and why our watersheds matter to the Blackfoot people.
Okay, itamik skunato ni nistonagok ni napiksi nohto to kaena nohto tetapi mamio iksapaitse tapiks. My name is Ninapiksi, chief bird from the bird spirit. The Old Man River, the beginning of time, started from a puddle. Then it started going into like a trench and a deep hole in the ground. And it slowly filled up. And from there, it kept filling up and it slowly formed into a little stream. From the little stream, more water and the crater Napi, the story of Napi. And so more water and fluids or liquids were poured in and collected, and it slowly overflowed from this deep hole in the ground. And then with the snow and ice, it slowly gathered, collected, and started flowing east. It did not flow west because of the direction of the sun coming up from the east. And so in our language, we would say in Napi Tchta, flowing towards the east, in Napi Kuyu, and slowly got bigger and wider and deeper. Then the fish came through and started using that as their home. Then the four-leggeds came after that, and then all the other birds and animals that use water, and that's just about every animal. And then the water life, the otter and the beaver, started using the water. And so this all kind of came through like an orderly fashion, but it started from a puddle of water that slowly went into like a trench, and then it overflowed. And thus the Old Man River started and was created by Napi, and that's why we call it Old Man. Napi created that water flow. We hold the waters, the rivers, in this case, the Old Man of ceremony. It's water is connected to ceremony. We have the beaver bundle, the very first sacred bundle to the Blackfoot people, and that started from water. The actual origin of beaver bundle was a different water stream, but at the same time, the beavers that were in the Old Man also represented that bundle. And so more bundles from the beaver bundle ceremony started from that. And then we have the sacred otter, Emunisi. And so all these animals, the water beings, and incidentally, the beaver bundle, we call it Ksikstakiachkuiniman, beaver bundle. And those are very old ceremony. Also, the songs originated from the water and the beaver. Those were not man-made songs put together. They were all spiritual in the beginning of time. When the beaver came out of the water, transformed into a man, and then a man told the people, this is what you will do. So we've been doing the beaver bundle opening ceremonies within the Blackfoot territory since then. Then you take the water birds. The chief spirit of the water birds is the loon. And so the loon also plays an important role. So you could take and you could see how the water connects the water animals, the water birds, and then the four-leggeds, the bison, the ini, the deer, the moose, all those animals that need the water to survive. with no water, no, none of these animal beings, water beings, would have survived. So the essence of the water was important to the animals, and the water beings first then transformed into our ceremonies, which we still practice today. And from those ceremonies, many of the Blackfoot language words were born and arrived from that. Even the names of the animals arrived, and that is part of our language system now. And so you could see the abundance of connections interrelated to the Blackfoot world and culture. It's not just water. It's more than just water.
Next, I would learn about settler development and one controversial project that people gave a damn about.
So, as I understand, this little thing here used to be, basically, it was a dock designed for people who are floating down the river. They could take this diversion canal and then use this as a dock to get out. Oh. So it's like a convenient, like, exit point.
Yeah. But now it's no longer, you
know. It's just, yeah, like been essentially left to crumble.
I'm Tyler Stewart, a curator for the Galt Museum and Archives. If there's like kind of three pillars of the Southern Alberta economy, or like the quote unquote economic development of the area, which started in the late 1800s, it would definitely be, you know, mining, the railroad, and irrigation. And I feel like, water is something we often take for granted and just, you know, expect it to be there. But I feel like a lot of people don't understand how much the watersheds have been kind of manipulated, changed, rerouted, managed, I guess is the like way that people in government like to say it, the management of the watershed. But really, it's that people, you know, particular settler culture has really like manipulated or changed the way our watershed has flown, the way it has not flown because of damming and reservoirs, those types of things, because of irrigation canals. So definitely a lot has changed in, you know, it's been about 150 years since that kind of like management of the watershed has really taken place. I think another interesting thing about like how all this started, so, you know, kind of the history of irrigation in Southern Alberta is connected to, you know, settler colonialism and particularly the Mormon Church. So Joseph Card, who is the namesake of Cardston, the town of Cardston, an hour or so south of Lethbridge here, the Mormon Church had like a deal with the Galts. So Alexander Galt and Elliot Galt, his son, who, you know, kind of known as some of the founders of Lethbridge, but, you know, were exploiting the coal resources of the area and using their positions in government to get access or early access to the economic kind of prosperity of the area. They had a deal with the Mormon Church essentially to build a lot of the irrigation canals that started coming up in the very late 1800s and more so in the early 1900s. So I think that like story of settling Southern Alberta is really a lot about like the management of the resources, and in particular the watershed management, because as we know, it's like a very dry place, right? We're in a kind of semi-arid desert. And so the, you know, European settlers moving from out east or from places in Europe where they didn't really have so much that type of climate that we do have here in Southern Alberta. You know, the first expeditions out west, I think it was Palliser, you know, one of the first explorers basically said like, Southern Alberta is not good for, I mean, he wouldn't have called it Southern Alberta at the time, but it was part of the Northwest Territories, but it was like, that area is not good for like settlement or for agriculture. Like we should go around it, keep going to BC, like keep going west kind of thing. But of course, like, you know, that was part of the settler colonial project to kind of like settle as much of the land as possible. And so, yeah, the church, the Mormon Church in particular, was like definitely involved in like bringing lots of settlers here to build projects like the irrigation canals, which in exchange for that work, they were paid half in cash and half in land. So through the development of irrigation canals in Southern Alberta, that was also like a settler colonial project to like occupy and settle the land. So they're all kind of intertwined things in a lot of ways.
Were there any sort of kind of challenges as they were developing this area for irrigation?
For sure, challenges just in that, you know, it's easy to think of how a construction project happens today with like big machinery versus in, you know, 1904 or some of the earlier canals that were built in like, you know, the late 1880s, 1890s, which were kind of like, you know, hand dug ditches and took a very long time to build. So that was kind of the solution was like, you know, not having a lot of that big machinery, you just get a lot of people to dig and work for a long time. So I'd say that's, you know, probably one of the main kind of challenges was just, you know, construction doesn't unfold in a year. It takes multiple years to build some of these irrigation canals. And a lot of them did take, you know, a decade to kind of reach their completion. And it's not like they all kind of were built at once, like what we see as like the irrigation districts in and around Lethbridge. So there's like multiple different irrigation districts. You know, some of them weren't kind of finished or built until later on. It wasn't until like the 40s when like the St. Mary's River, the St. Mary's Reservoir kind of was built. And so it, like full irrigation canal systems didn't reach places like Medicine Hat until later, you know, into the 40s. So as different kind of phases of those projects happened, they reached different areas. And also there was like other economic factors happening too, right? Like a lot of the, so kind of like the first period of irrigation development expansion was kind of like the small scale stuff, which would have been the late 1800s, like individuals building irrigation canals for their kind of own use and for like, you know, community use. So like Cardston was one of the first communities to build their own irrigation kind of system. And then like the very late 1800s into around 1915, like basically up until World War One, it was like the bigger projects that were financed by groups like the Galts, like the Alberta Coal and Navigation Company, these types of conglomerates that were starting to form to not just do irrigation, but they were also, like I said before, connected to mining, connected to railways. So those kind of like those companies had kind of each of those three different things kind of happening usually simultaneously to help exploit the natural resources, but also then like ship them off to markets, those kind of things. So yeah, kind of complex connected systems there. But then you had something like World War One happening where it's like, well, basically irrigation construction and all those projects kind of stopped for a while. And then after the war, people needed jobs again. There was like, you know, a lot of depression happening in the 20s and 30s. So there was kind of, you know, make work projects, build other phases of things. And then again, in World War Two, kind of irrigation expansion kind of like came to a halt almost. And then the big scale projects again kind of started happening in the late 40s and 50s, where you start seeing those big dams like St. Mary's Reservoir, the Gardner Dam in Saskatchewan, all of those kinds of big projects.
Yeah. Was there anything else interesting about kind of the history in that 1800s to kind of World War II to the 60s? Anything else you want to maybe touch on around there?
You know, that's something we take for granted today, and like living in Lethbridge is, you know, not a constant discussion, but a frequent discussion is like, you know, we need a third bridge here in Lethbridge, that kind of debate. And thinking about, you know, when this area was settled and when people were moving around in the, you know, mid to late 1800s, bridges weren't just everywhere to cross rivers, right? It was either you found a shallow ford crossing or you move stuff across the river using either horses or boats or rafts or something like that. So when you know, folks like Nicholas Sharon first showed up in the area and was starting like kind of small scale mining, Nicholas Sharon was also one of the first people who ran a ferry to cross what we call now the Old Man River. So originally close to Fort Whoopup, he was running like a ferry that was just like two flat bottom boats to get people back and forth across the river. And then later moved his kind of operations just west of the Galt Museum across the river. So that's where kind of Nicholas Sharon's mine was established. I think it was around 1882, but he was also running a ferry there. So he was kind of like the main ferryman getting people across the Old Man River if they were going west, you know, heading further west from what we call Lethbridge now, what was known as Coal Banks then. And so like that slow progress of, you know, taking it for granted these days, where it's like, oh, I want to go to the west side. Well, you hop in your car or your bike or whatever, cross the river on a bridge. There's two bridges. Whereas, you know, in the late 1800s, it was a slow travel getting across, either through a ferry. And then when bridges started to be constructed, like in the very early 1900s, you know, which were often washed away when there was a flood, you know, like here's a great new bridge. It's so much easier to get across the river. And then in next spring's flood season, oh, well, there goes the bridge. And it takes 2 years to build a new one. And what we think of a bridge today compared to what a bridge in reality was in 1902, very much a different structure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Maybe they had more of a connection to the river possibly because it was much more present and intimate. I feel like when you're driving across the bridge, like you see the river, but you don't really get close to it, right? Do you feel like there maybe would have been a difference then? They were maybe closer to the river, more had more interaction with it?
Definitely. Well, when this like community of coal banks was first established, it wasn't like it was today where the community exists up above the river valley. The community was in the river valley. So, you know, in the late 1800s, lots of houses were built down there. And there was, you know, Blackfoot folks were camping down there still. And even like there was housing in the Lethbridge River Valley into the 1960s. Like that was the 1960s was when the last of the structures kind of finally left. And again, this was because of occasional flooding where homes would get destroyed or washed away. So I feel like, yeah, in the early 1900s, the community of coal banks, which I in the early 1900s became, it was renamed to Lethbridge, you know, that connection to the river valley would have been more, you know, immediate, like proximate speaking, but also like a better appreciation for its, like, you know, as a life source for the community, a literal life source for the community. Whereas I feel like you said, a lot of folks today living in Lethbridge, you're driving from the south side to the west side, you're going over the bridge and you're seeing the river, but you're not kind of as immersed in it. Like it's not as like present or like immediately tangible in a certain way that it would have been when this community was first founded, you know, living down in that river valley and experiencing the river in a more immediate way.
Yeah, I guess we could talk a little bit more about the dams. Yeah, maybe tell me about some of kind of the history of the development of that. So you said it was about in the 60s that was starting?
Kind of like post-World War II is when these, and like this is across what we would call like the South Saskatchewan River Basin. So we know the Old Man River eventually flows into the South Saskatchewan River, goes all the way to Lake Winnipeg, eventually goes to Nelson River into Hudson Bay. So we're part of like one of the biggest watershed systems in North America. And thinking about how all that is managed now is vastly different than, you know, how those waterways and how the watershed flowed in the 1800s, 1900s. So, you know, these projects didn't just like pop up overnight. They've like the Old Man River Dam, which is more or less just a little northeast of Pincher Creek for those who kind of want to geographically situate that in their minds. You know, that was more than a 10-year project.
I would learn about the development of the dam from someone who was involved with the flow regime planning of this project.
I'm Stuart Rood. I'm a professor of environmental science at the University of Lethbridge. This was a precedent-setting project, not just for Alberta, but for Canada and even worldwide. It had been anticipated back in the 1920s when the diversion weir, the Lethbridge Northern Irrigation District weir, was implemented on the Picani Reserve, and that diverts water for a fairly major irrigation system north of the Old Man River, hence the name. Now, the problem with a weir is that it diverts water offstream, but it doesn't allow for storage and trapping of the spring flow. And so a storage reservoir, again, had been anticipated from the onset. The location of it was uncertain at the time, and there were studies through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. With the drought of the 1980s, which was as severe as the drought of the 1930s, the decision was finally made by Premier Peter Lougheed to go ahead. There was controversy relative to the location, but it needed to be upstream from the diversion weir. So this might have been on the Picani Reserve, it might have been upstream, or it might have been up in the Rocky Mountain areas in a zone called the Gap. The decisions were partly engineering, but they were also influenced by the social, cultural, and political factors. The site that was chosen was called the Three Rivers site because there were three rivers that were, in fact, entering this reservoir and stored: the Old Man, the Castle, and the Crow's Nest. And it's interesting that when the site was proposed, Three Rivers seemed like a positive in that here we can have one dam and collect water from three rivers. But of course, with the reversal relative to the valuation, it was subsequently called the Old Man River Dam, perhaps to slightly reduce the perception of impact.
So it wasn't, I haven't read all of the reports, but from my studying of the topic, that site was not necessarily the best site from an environmental perspective. But again, it was the best site, or not necessarily the best site, but it had a lot of positive aspects from an economic perspective. Of course, the Piikani First Nation didn't necessarily agree with that. And there was a lot of back and forth about like whether the dam would actually be located more closer to Brockett and it would have been co-managed or potentially like primarily run by Piikani First Nation. Eventually, the selection of the site at that Three Rivers site north of Pincher Creek was made without consultation. So when it was first announced, a lot of people were taken off guard, both like folks from Piikani and all of the farmers and ranchers in that area, because, you know, if you look on a map, that Old Man Reservoir is like pretty huge. It definitely changed the landscape in terms of what was there before got, you know, flooded because of the reservoir. When that decision was made, there was a lot of protest. This led to the founding of an organization called Friends of Old Man River. So they were kind of the primary folks, aside from Piikani First Nation, that were kind of fighting the government of Alberta in court in terms of saying, you know, why is this site being selected? Is this even a good idea? What is this going to do to the landscape? And, you know, that was almost 40 years ago now.
I'm Cliff Wallace. I'm a director with the Alberta Wilderness Association. That's a volunteer position. And I'm the past president of the Friends of the Old Man River. So Friends of the Old Man was a group that kind of formed out of the Alberta Fish and Game Association, Southern District out of Lethbridge, as well as the Alberta Wilderness Association, because it was issue specific. There was a problem. The Environment Conservation Authority and the Environment Council of Alberta had recommended against building a dam. We knew that it wasn't economic, and we knew of the problems that it would create for fisheries and the riparian habitats and that. And so we just started down the road, what can we do to stop this project? And we looked through one law after another. We started with some cultural sites under the Historical Resources Act, because there's a lot of First Nations sites in that area. And we thought there might be something there, but there wasn't. But we eventually kind of meandered around and got to this thing called an ERP guidelines, or a federal environmental assessment requirement that the Minister of Environment was supposed to do, and it hadn't been done. So we went to court, and that takes money. Fortunately, we had lawyers who were working some pro bono, but there's still fees and other things you got to cover, and there's a lot of work to do. So we needed to organize some fundraising efforts, one of them being this Old Man concert. And so some of our supporters were very well connected to the musician side of things, Ian Tyson, for example, and Gordon Lightfoot. And so they started putting this idea together. We're going to hold a concert on the banks of the Old Man. And I didn't realize what that meant. Of course, never done anything of that scale before. But they were confident, and we had great talent. And David Suzuki was lined up, and we actually went to the government and said, we want the highways campsite at Maycroft. We've invited the premier. And the guy gave us permission. Okay, we're on. And it was raining all around us that day. And when everybody got over their muddy roads and everything to the campsite, The sun came out. It was sunshine, this hole of sunshine on the concert site. And we'd brought in two B-trains as our stage, porta-potties all the way from Strathmore, and just had, there was an estimate of 10 to 12,000 people there. They were lined up for miles up highway, what is now Highway 22. And it was just a glorious time, right? We weren't there actually to raise a lot of money. Their first thought is we just want to break even. But the crowd was great. The entertainment was great. And David Suzuki drew the biggest round of applause, which was kind of strange because the reports were all these people just came for a free concert, but they were clearly committed to the environment. When we did the cleanup after, there wasn't even a single cigarette butt to pick up. There was some quarters and things like money, which had dropped out of the bags because we didn't realize we had these green garbage bags, and I had a little Suzuki Jeep, and it was stuffed full of green garbage bags with dollar bills, which we had dollar bills back then, and quarters and $5 bills and $20 bills. And there was over $20,000, which we took to the Hong Kong Bank in Calgary the following day, going down 8th Avenue, carrying these green garbage bags. And we had, you know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you're taking the Biffies back and everything else, taking it out, but just the vibe and the commitment of the people said we're on the right track here.
Cheryl Bradley was there, and she shared some memories with me.
I was almost brought to tears seeing all the people who had come from all over Alberta to celebrate the Old Man River. And I have images of just rows and rows and rows of people up the hillside. They brought lawn chairs or were sitting on the grass. The stage was at the edge of the river valley, and then the audience just flocked up the hillside. And I remember clowns. There were clowns on stilts tossing balls. There were all sorts of No Damn Way t-shirts. But there was not... None of it was negative. None of it was dissing anybody. It was just all more, we really value our rivers. Here you are. Here's the, from the hilltop. There's the stage, and there's the people, and there's the cars going all the way up and back, and here's a good shot of the audience. There's the Joe Crowshoe and other chiefs sort of blessing the event. Gordon Lightfoot, Murray McLaughlin.
Is David there?
Yeah. David Suzuki, Murray McLaughlin. Everybody wanting autographs. I think he was going to brush his teeth with Sprite. Gordon Lightfoot, Sid Marty. Sid had poems. And there's the clown.
Yeah.
Very colorful. It was great. And the No Damn Way, Martha and Cliff. This was the former president of Fish and Game, Don Hayden, was there.
It definitely made history. I mean, it was the pictures, and it's a part of history that we didn't think would go anywhere. But that court case continued on. After many different lower level courts, which went one way for us, then the other way for us, or against us, we got to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled that this is the law of the land, and that the Alberta government had been obstructionist, and they actually awarded double costs, which is very unusual. So it was a kind of a slap on the wrist to the Alberta government in the way that they had handled things. But I think out of that, the federal government was actually waiting to create this new Environmental Assessment Act. And that Canadian Environmental Assessment Act was largely based on the outcome of the case. If that case hadn't gone our way, I think we'd be in a very different situation. And it still is, parts of that act, if you wish, are still in the legislation today.
Oh, that's really interesting. And so, and what does that act all entail?
It means that certain projects must undergo a federal review. And so anytime there's an area of federal responsibility, that could be fisheries for sure. And that was one of the hooks in terms of the Old Man River. Then there has to be an environmental assessment. We've seen now their involvement in things like the Grassy Mountain coal mine. There's indigenous issues. In that case, there was also West Slope cutthroat trout, again, a fisheries issue. So anytime there's an area of federal responsibility or federal money involved in something, there has to be a federal review.
Okay. And that concert was kind of a part of that coming into being.
Was part of the history of getting that case done, because it wasn't simple. It wasn't just a one-stop shopping. We actually had to go through everything, and in various cases, because we were also going after some of the people in government, and they had threatened us, me specifically, with a slap suit. And so we had to work through those issues as well. And I guess all I can say, there's satisfaction at the end of it, because those same people, it was the first time in British law history that a government had been found to have committed on another dam project fraud, misrepresentation, and awarded a construction company multi-millions of dollars in damages because they had falsified documents and basically lied to landowners about various things. And those are the same people who are in charge of the Old Man River Dam. There's many fights. And I mean, I guess what kept us going is we had assisted another group, the Canadian Wildlife Federation and the Saskatchewan Wildlife Federation, on the Rafferty-Alameda Dam in southern Saskatchewan. And they caved before their court cases were over. They stopped their work. Not sure why, but the people in the Canadian Wildlife Federation just said, no, we're, you know, our members down there, whatever it was, didn't want to continue. And they were far enough along that they would have probably prevented the Old Man Dam from ever being built, because they were going down the same path to the Supreme Court that we were. They were a year ahead of us. And unfortunately, by the time the Supreme Court decision came out for us, the dam was half built. So then we were dealing really, even though the panel that heard, because the ruling was you have to review this project. And so a panel was struck, which included people from Alberta, but it was a federal panel. And they heard the arguments on both sides. And their first recommendation was to decommission the dam. And they had, unfortunately, another series of recommendations, which was, because in their mind, they knew that wasn't going to be accepted by the federal government or the provincial government. And so they had a set of, I think, 23 recommendations about what to do if you were going to continue building. And that's, I got involved in the Old Man Dam Environmental Advisory Committee and worked on that so that at least the water that was going to be stored and the way it was developed would be used for optimizing stream flow for fish and riparian habitat downstream. But it wasn't going to fix all the problems that were created by losing that habitat and the degradation of the streams upstream of the reservoir. It's interesting because one of the MPs for Southern Alberta said, we want to build a dam on the Milk River. We want to build a dam on the South Saskatchewan River. But if the environmentalists make a peep, it won't happen. Well, it hasn't happened yet. The Old Man was kind of the nail in the coffin for a lot of uneconomic and crazy environmentally destructive projects. That court case was seminal, and it's now being taught in law schools, in environmental law courses, as, you know, one of the landmark cases in Canada. And so those are the building blocks. You know, we like to say we stand on the shoulders of giants. There's always somebody before us that was big in pushing these things forward, but they weren't giants by themselves. They needed a lot of people helping them, writing letters, talking to people, giving money to nonprofit groups that are working on these issues.
Later, Tyler told me about another group that protested the dam.
In, I believe it was 1991, when there was a group of Piikani folks called the Lone Fighters, and Milton Born with a Tooth was kind of one of the leaders of that protest. They actually took direct action beyond protesting and attempted to divert water away from the construction of the dam, essentially using bulldozers to reroute the water to have it flow as it would have otherwise flowed instead of being like diverted and held. And this was around the same time you had other kind of police indigenous confrontations, like the Oka events in Quebec. Milton Bourne with the Tooth had actually gone to Oka to like visit with the Mohawk people and say, like, how are you resisting these like incursions by the government onto your land? And then he came back to Southern Alberta to find that like the RCMP were on Piikani territory, like basically trying to thwart these efforts to reroute the course of the river. And essentially what happened was that Milton Bourne with the Tooth fired off a couple shots from a rifle in the air as like warning shots to say, you know, get off our land. This is a confrontation. What are you doing here? And eventually was arrested and in a multi-year court case, which was prosecuted. He was found guilty, and then they declared a new trial because the original judge had like excluded a bunch of evidence or excluded any testimony about the like cultural significance of the river to the Piikani people. So it's quite a complex situation, but you could see that you know, Blackfoot folks were the ones like taking real significant action to stand up to the construction of this dam. The Friends of the Old Man River were kind of they came at the protest around the Old Man River Dam from an environmental perspective, while the Piikani First Nations came at the protest or like resistance to this Old Man River Dam construction from a like cultural kind of perspective. You know, they had shared interests, but from my understanding, they maybe didn't agree on the approach. So they weren't necessarily aligned all the time. So while you had kind of more direct action, like folks like Milton Bourne with the Tooth, like literally rerouting the river and like having these like direct confrontations with authorities, the Friends of Old Man River, you know, were like very much awareness raising kind of focused. So this, you know, massive concert in Maycroft in 1989 was a pretty significant event. And I think it's interesting because similar things have happened here in just like the past couple of years in Alberta, where it's easy for people to say that Alberta is like there's the rednecks and then there's the lefties or whatever. You know, there's the rural folks who are all conservative ranchers and then there's the lefty tree huggers. When in fact, that's not really how it works. You have folks like Ian and Sylvia Tyson being the primary organizers along with the Friends of the Old Man River of this massive benefit concert. So Ian and Sylvia Tyson, you know, legendary country musicians in Alberta, were the couple of the headline performers, along with Gordon Lightfoot and Murray McLaughlin, you know, at the time, massive like folk country kind of icons in Canadian music. I think another cool little bit about that fundraising concert was David Suzuki was actually there as well. Kind of one of the big like emotion provoking speeches of the day, because, you know, David Suzuki is, you know, kind of an icon of environmentalism in Canada. But in 1989, he was like a journalist and he had just been fired from the Globe and Mail, like just before this concert happened, because he, you know, his editors found him to be like too left leaning or too environmental leaning and not objective enough. So, you know, around that time period of the Old Man River Dam construction and this concert, it's like kind of a pivotal moment in the way environmentalism and the environmental kind of like movement was kind of like perceived, I think, in a lot of ways, or things kind of starting to change in people's mindsets in terms of like what environmentalism means or why it's important to kind of be thinking about a lot of these things. And back to, you know, like the establishment of irrigation in the area, part of that whole story is as well this idea of man conquering nature to a certain extent. You know, like we can build irrigation canals. You know, people said this semi-arid desert was inhospitable for agriculture and inhospitable for settlement to build new communities. But look at us. We can control the river. We can push it this way, push it that way, send irrigation all across the province. We can build dams. We can harness the river and use it for the benefit of humankind. And, you know, in the settlement of the area, that was certainly part part of the narrative of like, look at this oasis we've built in the desert. And we're not the only place who's done that, right? Like places like Arizona, Nevada, that was very much part of the like nation building narrative of we can control nature. We can live anywhere we want to. We can have green lawns in Las Vegas or in Lethbridge. You know, that's certainly part of how these systems kind of get established, is that like dominance over nature kind of concept. And I think it's becoming more and more clear in recent years with the, you know, the massive changes we're seeing from climate change. That narrative is and always has been problematic, but is beginning to like not just crack, but crumble. And that if we don't start to make significant social and cultural changes in the way that the watershed is managed and, you know, drawn upon, that the lifestyle that is the kind of normal mainstream lifestyle of city dwellers in southern Alberta is not going to be sustainable for that much longer.
Next time on the Old Man Watershed, I get a water treatment plant tour and learn about the City of Lethbridge's climate adaptation plan.
So the climate adaptation strategy and action plan, what it aims to do is provide some guidance to the City of Lethbridge on how to better prepare for and respond to climate events, including extreme weather events.
In Over My Head's The Old Man Watershed season was produced by Michael Bartz in partnership with Environment Lethbridge. Special thanks to all the guests who gave generously of their time and expertise.
I'm trying to save the planet. Oh, will someone please save me?
This season was made possible with financial assistance from Land Stewardship Center's Watershed Stewardship Grant, funded by Alberta Environment and Protected Areas. Opinions expressed in this season are those of In Over My Head.